This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley, and my guest today is author Brittany Newell, who loves to write about the secret worlds of others, the things people do, she says, that make their lives more bearable. Her newest novel, Softcore, takes the reader into San Francisco's underworld of dive bars, strip clubs, and BDSM dungeons, where tech bros, executives, and outcasts live out their fantasies. Ruth, the protagonist, is a stripper who unravels when her ex-boyfriend, a ketamine dealer, disappears. Ruth, known by her stripper name, Baby Blue, starts working as a professional dominatrix where she tries to fulfill the deepest desires of her clients, who mostly want to talk to her about how lonely they are and the grief they carry. Brittany Newell draws from personal experience. In addition to being a writer, she is also a professional dominatrix. A graduate of Stanford University, she studied comparative literature and gender studies and wrote her debut novel, Ula, in 2017 when she was 21 years old. It's been described as the millennial Lolita. Newell has written for The New York Times, Joyland, and Playgirl. She and her wife run a monthly drag and dance party called Angels at Aunt Charlie's Lounge, which is one of San Francisco's oldest queer bars. Now, before Brittany and I get into our conversation, I want to warn you that this is an adult conversation, not appropriate for children. We won't be discussing sex in an explicit way, but this is an adult conversation with adult themes and topics, including sex work. With that, Brittany Newell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm over the moon.
Yes, well, thank you for being here. I really enjoyed your book. It was such a good read. And I want to know, first off, how much of Softcore is fiction and how much of it is based on real life?
Oh, yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I have seen some early reviewers saying that it's a memoir, which it is definitely not. I want that to be clear, but I think it's a completely valid question. And I catch myself doing it as a reader, too, like the conflation of the main character with the author. And so I, of course, have thought about this a lot and been asked this a lot. And I think the ways that it is non-fictional are sort of subtler than one might realize. Like, I think the sensory details of my life and the characteristics of the people that I'm close to and that I've spent a lot of time noticing and observing, I think those are always the things that end up making their way into a book, which is sort of like, I always say, like the tax of dating or loving or befriending a writer, is that all of these sort of like very specific, intimate, sometimes seemingly insignificant details are the things that end up being like woven into the book and making it have like the texture of real life. Like, and in a way that it's like probably only like that person would see themselves in it when they read it and be like, oh, like that's brand of perfume that I use.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, oh, like that's my like turmeric colored bedspread.
Right. I mean, I could see why, knowing that your main character, Ruth, she has a master's degree. She's working in these underworlds. And like you, you are a Stanford graduate, and you have a really interesting story into your foray into these worlds, which we're going to get to in just a moment. But Ruth, the protagonist in the book, she's also known as her stripper name, Baby. And one of the more powerful elements of your writing is that you not only explore what's in it for the guys that she services, you also explore outside of money what's in it for her to be a stripper and a dominatrix. How would you describe Ruth?
Oh, that's a great question. I think Ruth is lonely, and it actually has made me reflect a lot on my writing in general. And I think I'm always writing about characters who are defined by their longing. And motivated by like trying to fill the God-shaped hole inside of them, to use like 12-step language. And so I think Ruth is a holy person, like H-O-L-E-Y, as perhaps we all are. Yeah, and I think she has a lot of reservations about her own lovability and also her own desirability, which maybe is one of the many reasons why she enjoys her work as a stripper and later as a dominatrix. And I think she's a very curious person, which probably would be the main ways that I think I'm like Ruth. Like, I actually think I'm very different from Ruth, but we do share that fundamental curiosity and like an attraction to underworlds or shadows, maybe. Like, I feel like she's very unafraid of things that other people might deem like seedy or grubby. I think she feels at ease in those environments or with those types of people.
Well, one of the things that Ruth does throughout the book is kind of make clear that she sees herself as average. And she does this like in her description of her physicality, what she looks like. She's like the girl next door. I think that she said that she made men's mangy dreams come true.
Yeah.
Why was it important for Ruth to be kind of an average girl with an average body in this world?
Yeah. Well, I think I wanted it to be real and I wanted it to be empathetic and relatable and realistic and all of these things. Like, so I think, and it makes Ruth, I think, a more like a character that we would see everywhere and a person who, yeah, isn't this like flashing billboard image of a woman, even though in the sex work worlds, that's always, you know, what you're portraying or the role that you're stepping into. But even for the most, you know, like gorgeous woman working as a stripper or whatever, like that would always be a fantasy or a role that one is inhabiting. And I think all women, like regardless of what they look like, are actually like really good at that and are really like learn to, yeah, to play the role and to understand what someone wants before they understand it themselves. That's probably what makes an excellent sex worker, I think, is that almost like mind reading empathy and the ability to shape shift. And actually, I think that that's another big part of like Ruth's averageness kind of being a benefit to her in these worlds is it allows her to shape shift. And in general, she's a shapeshifter, like outside the club as well.
How did you go from being a Stanford graduate to a dominatrix?
Well, I guess probably the useless gender studies degree. No, I'm just kidding. But
right, because you did, right, you did study queer
gender, yeah, exactly.
And, yeah, contemporary fiction. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think when I graduated, you know, I had the bizarre and like gorgeous, but also very weird experience of publishing my book, you know, like, so I wrote it when I was, I guess, like 20, and then it came out right when I graduated. So, you know, that was amazing. And I think for me, and still actually, like the most important thing to me upon graduating was wanting to have freedom and control of my time. And once my advance from the first book rather quickly ran out, I did the usual food service jobs, bartender, waitress, and anyone who's worked in food service knows how, you know, taxing that can be, like, mentally and psychically. And so I think, like, many artists and many people, I started to despair because I felt like I was losing this control of my time and my space. And so I think, like, all of the decisions I made around the types of work that I would end up going into were originally driven by this desire for freedom and control of my time. And, you know, like if you can work one day of the week for $800 an hour and then have the rest of the week to write, that's the dream, you know, that's
yeah,
what
right.
has. And then I think once I got into it, in addition to the freedom and control of my time, you know, there were then I started to fall in love with it for the curiosities that like how it satisfied my own curiosities and the excitement of it and just, you know, like I'm a writer, so I'm always interested in stories, and I kind of like randomly found this job or this type of work where people are always telling you not just their stories, but they want to tell you their secrets, you know, and I love to listen. So I kind of felt almost like called to the job, you know, like as someone who wants nothing more than to be like a keeper of these masculine secrets, or to be a witness to people's longings and a witness to their grief. Like it felt, you know, and not to say that I didn't have like weird sessions or rude clients, like, of course, like I never want to give off this impression that, you know, everything is always like rosy.
Sitting down and talking, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this is so fascinating to me, because one of the things in reading this book that I kept thinking about is that you also have to sit in this seat of non-judgment for all of the requests that come to you. Is there ever a moment where you do judge, or where do you put yourself as far as your mental space to come to the table so that you can accept whatever, as long as you're safe, of course, whatever is being requested of you or brought to you as a fantasy?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, like as a dominatrix and a provider, I have, you know, my own limits, and I have the things that I really enjoy. Like I love cross-dresser sessions. Like I feel like I'm the perfect person for that, because I have lots of cross-dressers in my regular life too. And you know, there's things that I don't do either because I, mainly more just because I feel like I'm not good at it. But to answer your question more specifically, you know, if someone's presenting me with a fantasy, like this disembodied fantasy, I think in general, I would like to think I'm a very open-minded person. And I don't think it's particularly hard to feel into their fantasy when, you know, the central longing or the central appetite behind the fantasy is clear to me, or is laid bare, you know, like so much of the time it's, you know, like it might seem inaccessible or insane, like a certain fantasy, but the heart of it is more relatable or familiar than maybe people would like to admit. So yeah, I guess it's about empathy, which, you know, I always like to say that what makes a good writer is also what makes a good dominatrix, which is empathy and curiosity and bravery. So I guess those things, like all coming together, make it not easy, but make me feel able to receive these fantasies. And I guess I think of myself, I said it earlier, but like to be a witness, you know, like to witness something and hold space for it, you know, even if it's not my particular...
Your cup of tea.
Yeah, right. Not my flavor.
Right.
But to witness it feels important.
Has there ever been an instance where you've seen these men in real life, in day-to-day life, at the grocery store, at the post office? And if that's the case, like, you just pretend, you just walk on by.
Right. Like a therapist, right? Like, I guess when your therapist sees you out in the world, they're not supposed to acknowledge you. The only once, actually, which is kind of interesting that it would only be once, and it was, I was late and walking to the dungeon to have a session with this person who was, like, killing time on the corner. And I remember he was wearing, you know, like the green M&M. He was wearing like a green M&M t-shirt and eating a piece of pizza. No, I was eating a piece of pizza. And I remember thinking like, oh no, this is like so like ruining his fantasy, because I'm wearing like street clothes and like wearing like my like ratty like faux fur jacket and eating pizza really hurriedly because I'm late to my session. And I remember we just like locked eyes, and then I just like kept walking. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, he's at the dungeon and we didn't acknowledge it.
Right, because that's part of the fantasy, is it stays what's in the dungeon stays in the dungeon.
Exactly. And, you know, his fantasy of a dominatrix would probably be someone who, like, lives and sleeps and eats in, like, a full latex suit, you know. So I felt kind of bad. I was like, oh, no, I, like, disrupted that fantasy for him with my pizza.
You know, something that... And I'm not going to give away, like, there are so many parts of the book that if we go too deep into it, like, it gives away the story. But something else that's really important is scent.
Yeah.
Your character, Baby, wears a unique fragrance that her ex-boyfriend has gifted her. And there's a moment where she talks about the sense of all the girls who work at this strip club with her and what they signify, what they bring to the experience. When and how did you learn how important scent is in this experience and in the fantasy?
That's interesting. I remember when I was shopping the book around, someone that I had sent it to rejected it, but wrote a really beautiful review of it and said, you know, all the things that they liked about it. And I remember they said, "I've never read so many different descriptions for how men smell." Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I became aware of how, I guess, like, fixated and like enchanted I am by smells, I guess, as a writer, first and foremost, and secondarily as a embodied person out in the world. And then, you know, now like doing interviews and stuff with Softcore, like so many people mention that. So it's like educational for me, like learning about my own self as like a writer and a, you know, sex worker, whatever, like that I have this like attention to scent and to smell. And I think, you know, I think that smell, how you smell and how you dress, you know, wherever you're going out in the world, wherever, going to work, going to a party, going on a date or whatever, I think those two things, smell and style, are the closest things we have to like casting spells, if you know what I mean. It's like a way to, you know, depending on what you wear, like how femme it is, like how sexy it is, and how you smell, like if it's
also the essence of who you are, you know.
Yeah, and it's an essence of who you are, but it's also something that can always change and can shapeshift, you know, depending on your mood or depending on the environment or depending on the person who's going to smell you, you know. And I guess that's one of the things that I love about smell. Is how it creates like a mood or an atmosphere. And I'm very, very particular and attuned to different smells, like the mood that comes with an amber smell is very different than the mood that would come with like a more like animalistic or leathery smell. So I guess honestly, in the same way that a name kind of casts a spell, I guess scents and smells do too. They just
that
like they yeah they set the setting or start to build the atmosphere of the person that you want to be that day.
Okay, this is a very probably naive question, but every time I hear the word dungeon, I'm literally thinking about a dungeon. Like, I'm literally, let's go down to the basement, open like a bolted door. But in the book, like, the dungeons are like rooms in a Victorian, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I will say every dungeon that I've ever worked in has always been an above ground, very nice, very clean, big, beautiful house. And yeah, they're not literally underground. I mean, dungeon is a word with a lot of like semiotic baggage, which is why I think on the website of the dungeon that Dreamhouse is the dungeon in the book, which is based on the very first dungeon that I ever worked at. I think they call it a BDSM playhouse, which is maybe, yeah, more expansive and allows for, you know, like images of the different types of fetishes or fantasies that, you know, are played out there.
Brittany, in Softcore, Ruth, she is very introspective, as you described, and she reflects somewhat tenderly about these guys that she services. I want to read this passage in particular that was pretty powerful. She says, quote, "Did I feel simpatico with the clients whose names and birthdays I can still recite to this day, Pledge of Allegiance style? Tim, 10-10-75, Pascal, 6-9-69. The oldest client I can remember was born in 1939. All I know, in fact, is this. Men are dying to be let in on the secret pleasures of girlhood. They feel cheated out of ease and glamour, friend kisses and hushed gossip. Heterosexuality is defined by a longing for wholeness. Terror undergirds desire." Brittany, is that true?
In my
From your
experience. Yeah, yes. Yeah. In my experience, yes. And I remember someone asking me once, like, has doing sex work and being a pro-dom, like, how has it changed your opinion or your relationship to men? Like, has it made you, like, a lot more, like, impatient or, you know, like, fed up because you have to deal with them so often? And the answer is that actually more than anything, it's made me have so much empathy for men that I certainly never would have had otherwise. Perhaps because, you know, because of the specific power structure of a BDSM session, you know, where I'm always in charge and they're coming to me in this state of vulnerability and openness, you know, in a way that is almost never replicated in the real world. I have this very rare and rarefied opportunity to witness all of the, like, pent up emotions and all of the anxieties and grief and desires that men carry around. And I think a stereotype that is pretty true is that not all the time, but a lot of the time, the types of men who book sessions with a pro dominatrix are, like, high-powered men who have demanding jobs and make a lot of decisions in their real life and are generally in positions of power or, you know, at least have to be dominant and in charge a lot of the time, which, you know, maybe is also true for all, you know, normative men to some degree, this, like, expectation of always being in charge and not showing your weakness or whatever. Yeah, and it maybe it's surprising to hear that, but it has definitely made me have a lot more empathy when I see how, you know, burdened all of these men are by the demands of toxic masculinity, you know, because I'm deeply and highly aware of how toxic masculinity hurts and burdens and alters women and non-binary people. But, you know, in a dungeon session, I'm getting a front row seat to how toxic masculinity has harmed them. And even, you know, even if they're, like, spelling it out or just in the nature of the scene where it just feels
fantasies.
Exactly. Right. And it just feels so good for them to just, like, let go in a way that they don't feel like they're able to in their actual lives or with their actual partners.
You grew up in Belvedere
in Marin
County,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's known as a pretty wealthy area, right?
Yeah, totally.
How would you describe your childhood?
I would describe it as Grey Gardens directed by John Waters.
What does that mean?
It was very dysfunctional and loving, but a lot of chaos and a lot of feeling different from the families around us and also, like, the other kids. Like, yeah, I guess maybe I would define it by a feeling of difference or otherness, which actually, to bring it back to one of your earlier questions, like, maybe that's one of the things that has made it, like, easy for me to be receptive to people's strange fantasies or things that are different or things that are weird. Because, yeah, there's just always been this attraction to other worlds and underworlds and edges. Like, ever since I was little, like, I remember, like, getting in trouble with my, not in trouble, but I remember the family, like, being like, oh my God, do you remember Netflix queues when, like, there was, like, the family have, like, a queue and you would, like, queue it up for the DVDs to get mailed and everyone would be like, oh my God, like, Brittany, like, commandeered the queue and it's, like, full of, like, movies about cross-dressers from other countries and she put, like, the Rocky Horror Picture Show in there again. And yeah, there was just always this obsession with, like, things that were queer and things that were other.
I think I asked you earlier, how important is it for you not to show judgment? And I'm also thinking about, like, what does the kink say, if anything, about the person? Do you put any of that on that? Like, you know, I'm sure you come across certain kinks that are just, like you talked about, the foot fetish. Like, that is one that I think, you know, all of us kind of know about. But, like, is there a specific, like, thing that a kink says about a person?
Yeah, I think it says a lot about, as I said at the very beginning, you know, I do believe that all characters, but also all people have are driven by this God-shaped hole inside of them. And I think that that can feed into, yeah, like what type of fetish or fantasy someone has. More generally, the level to which the person wants to surrender and like how much they want to let go, you know, that I think says a lot about a person and the intensity with which they pursue this desire.
How much responsibility do you hold in making certain that the person feels safe enough to let go? Because, you know, that's part of it.
Yeah, I feel so much responsibility. And, you know, of course, I feel a responsibility, you know, to keep them safe. But yeah, the emotional safety is a huge part of it. And wanting them to feel, well, it's funny, right? Because you want them to feel safe, but you also want them to feel scared and demeaned and
right,
shivering.
Right, because that's what they're coming to
you for.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finding that balance.
You know, you're young. We kind of bask in the glow of Ruth's youth in this book. Even though she does encounter OGs, like the woman who runs this house, you know, BDSM house, is there a life cycle for this kind of work? You know, I think it's obvious, like for stripping, for instance, but like in particular to be a dominatrix, is there an end date?
I don't think there's a particular age, but I do think that sex work in general is not something that you should plan to do forever, which, again, you know, is true of many jobs. But I feel that it is so exhausting and there is like a certain amount of like emotional drainage that happens that, and you know, inevitably it's, you know, it's also like the same thing with like, you shouldn't model forever. Well, I guess you can't model forever, but you know, there is like
like athletes. Right?
Yeah. But it does sort of change how you view yourself if you're not so careful with your boundaries. And the reality is that like most people start doing sex work when they're really, really young and don't have those boundaries in place. So actually, I would say it's better to start when you're a bit older, like at least 25, when your like prefrontal cortex has developed. I mean, not that I did that, but now that I'm 30 and looking back, I'm like, actually, I think it's better to start when you're a bit older and to have a plan for your future self. There are, of course, like dominatrixes of all ages. But I just think like how taxing it can be on your like psychic state is something that, yeah, you should
long
take care
term.
Of yourself in that way,
yeah.
You know, like because you're really absorbing so many people's energies and so much vulnerability and. Yeah, and you know, we are therapists, but we're maybe not trained therapists. So I think sometimes those boundaries can be slipperier than we realize until it's too late.
Do you know other careers that other DOMs have gone to once they leave this kind of work?
Well, literally, like therapists. Like I know so many DOMs and sex workers of all stripes who then become so interested in therapy because they realize that that's what they've been doing.
Brittany Newell, thank you so much for this book.
Thank
you. It
was
such a fun read, and this was such a delightful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. I had so much fun, and thank you so much for reading.
Brittany Newell's new book is titled Softcore.